From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. April 1985 marks the anniversaries, dating to the years 1564 and 1616 during the English Renaissance period, of the birth and death of William Shakespeare, the world's most popular poet and playwright. Following last week's discussion about Shakespeare's popularity and his position as a cultural reference point in Western art and literature, Soundings now presents a program about love, sex, and death in Shakespeare's tragedy Othello, The Moor of Venice. The panelists for Soundings are two Shakespearean scholars, Linda Boos and Margretta De Grazia. Linda Boos teaches at the University of California at Los Angeles. She's the editor of a forthcoming anthology entitled Fathers and Daughters, and she's written articles about Shakespeare's treatment of male-female relationships. Margretta De Grazia is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, she worked on a project entitled Speaking on Shakespeare's Terms. The discussion for Soundings begins with comments from Linda Boos about the historical circumstances in Elizabethan England that surrounded Shakespeare's composition of Othello.
I think there's a very important historical reason, because you've got a most unusual moment at the moment that English Renaissance drama springs to life, and that drama is fascinated by the male-female relationship. You have on the throne of England this unexpected monarch, the unexpected king, Queen Elizabeth, who called herself your female king, who suddenly, in this very male-dominated culture, you have a female wielding the power.
Mm-hmm. Now, wait, was there any humor in that? I mean, how serious was she to have made a statement like that?
I think it managed to co-opt everyone, in the sense you could not be rude to Elizabeth because she was, after all, a woman, mm-hmm. and she kept most of the courtiers right at court writing sonnets to her and competing with one another for her female favors and grace. At the same time, she also let them know, and I am your king at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So Elizabeth played a brilliant game out of gender.
Margretta?
I'd like to ask you, Linda, how you would define the difference between male and female in Shakespeare's plays, because every time that I sit down to think of a truly distinct difference between the two, I find that any attribute I might assign to women, I can extend to men, so that if I say something like, women have trouble with their fathers, I think of Hamlet, and I think of Hamlet and Fortinbras and Laertes, the three sons, and to what extent they're dominated by the pasts of their fathers. When I think women have trouble situating themselves in a language that is essentially phallocentric, you see to what extent males are excluded and thwarted and frustrated by it too. I just have a very hard time finding an attribute that I can assign to females in Shakespeare that I cannot also claim for males. And I realize that's a very radical and maybe a very radical statement that perhaps betrays my thick-headedness, but it's something that troubles me a good deal when I read feminist criticism and see the women's plight singled out, yet cannot see it as being singly and singularly a woman's problem within the plays.
In a way, I agree with you, and in a way, I do think that Shakespeare gives us a differentiation. For instance, on the problems of with the fathers, that the males seem trapped inside of the father's demand to repeat his career, to live out his goals. The daughters, on the other hand, seem much more trapped by the father's retentive possessiveness. They seem to be trapped with the problem of getting outside of the family and leaving the father and finding their own lives. The Cordelia problem, the Desdemona problem, the retentive father who wants to hold on to the daughter. The fathers don't try and hold on to the sons inside of the family in the same way. They seem to want the son to go out and repeat the father's career. The pattern seems a problem mm-hmm. for both son and daughter with the father, but they're slightly different problems. We don't have many mothers in Shakespeare, we have very few mother-daughter relationships to look at. We've got a lot of mother-son dynamics, and the intensity there is quite important and impressive. the main way I see the differentiation, though, is in terms of what I think is a reflection of Shakespeare's recognition of the power that our cultural role models, the expectations of living up to one's cultural role model, has on all people, whether it be living up to one's masculine mode, which you see Macbeth. So, I mean, all one need to do to Macbeth, and perhaps this is very true contempt even right now, is say, be a man. Instant response to that. And the coercive power that that idea, that implicit idea of masculinity seems to have. I don't think you could say, be a woman. It just doesn't have any profound effect. The women seem to be very much trapped inside between the virgin and whore definitions. Mm-hmm. I don't think Shakespeare traps them there. I think he exposes this as a problem in the culture and explores it, mm-hmm. explores the extent to which that traps women, that kind of definition traps them, and limits their behavior, makes them blind sometimes to what they're doing to avoid being called the whore.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly see that configuration, the virgin and the whore, recurring throughout the Renaissance. It's absolutely pervasive, whether you're looking in the dramas or in narratives or certainly in sonnet sequences. It's absolutely central. But what I also see is that dichotomy that is represented in woman is the same dichotomy that's implicit in male desire. That is, it too is bifurcated. The idealizing and the bestializing originates in man and then is projected onto woman, so that in the same way that it's her characteristic, it's also the characteristic of his desire for her. And I don't know where that leaves woman. I don't know to what extent she emerges from behind male projections onto her in Shakespeare's plays, because all of the representations of women, it seems so possible to reduce all of the representations of women to externalizations, embodiments of male desire.
Margareta de Grazia, Linda Boos, let's turn the conversation to a fairly specific focal point. Tell me about Othello. Linda, why is this play important to an understanding of the way Shakespeare views human sexuality, the relationships between men and women?
You know, I first got interested in the play when I noticed something very fascinating about its history, mm-hmm. 400 years.
You mean its staging?
Its staging, both in terms of its theatrical history and its history inside of literary criticism. That actually this is apparently the most popular of any of Shakespeare's plays. Over the 400 years, Othello has been the most theatrically popular one. It is something that arouses audiences and he's this enormous popularity on stage. Of all of the big tragedies, there is no play that the literary critics have disliked with the intensity, and I mean real intensity, it gets almost verbally violent, that they have Othello.
And yet it's been popular with
on
what?
Stage.
With theatergoers. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so this became rather fascinating to me, a very bifurcated response between looking at it intellectually and seeing it on stage. And what do we have going on here? The play, in many ways, I think, is a very disturbing play for men. Shakespeare's tragic hero, Othello, not only, first of all, he's a black man, but in addition to which, it's coming right up to the exploration of the very limits of human eroticism, sexual violence, a subject that makes us all nervous. I think it has been easier for men intellectually, and in their criticism reflects this, to identify with Macbeth, for instance, who, after all, has a much wider spread atrocities. He kills his king and his friends and their families and everyone else who gets in his way. But somehow, I think it may be psychologically easier for a man to imagine himself in some identity with Macbeth than to ever imagine himself erotically strangling his wife, killing her on their wedding sheets.
Well, now, we have several questions that are coming up here. First of all, Margareta de Grazia, how much was race an issue?
Well, I myself don't think race is an issue at all in Othello. I don't think Shakespeare knew of a race that he could identify with blackness. I think the blackness has significance that goes, that is quite other from a racial significance.
So this is a nationality that he's dealing with, not necessarily a race.
Not even a nationality. I wouldn't even want to do that. Uh-huh. I think that blackness symbolizes a strangeness. It symbolizes the unknown, the primordial unknown, the chaos, the darkness from which order is created. It could symbolize, too, a more potent male, a darker male. Mm-hmm. It certainly heightens the contrast between Desdemona and Othello, that he is black and she is fair, alabaster-like, like light.
But there's no ism that we're going to attach to a word like race in Shakespeare's use of a black man.
I think not. I don't think questions of race or religion are really relevant unless mm-hmm. there's a group within society that can be identified with that race or religion. And if there isn't, you know, a race within Elizabethan experience that can be identified as Negroid or black, and there isn't one. Mm-hmm. You know, they're scattered Moors, perhaps.
I see.
But so scattered that as a race, they can't possibly yet be identified. Othello's blackness gives his character a symbolic dimension.
Well, now, what about, we're talking about Shakespeare and sexuality, men and women. What about a moral blackness here in the form of Iago? Mm-hmm. Linda Booth's Margherita de Grazia, is the play about sex or is it about evil in the form of what happens to Desdemona because of her relationship with Othello, or is it about what Iago does to Othello, convinces him leads him to kill his wife, in effect. Linda?
If I had to boil it down to maybe one sentence, I would say, to me, the play is about the erotic relationship, erotic violence, and the very disturbing response that subject provokes. The play implicates its audience as complicitors. After all, we are watching this in a very voyeuristic relationship. Hmm. In the research I've done, this play is the very first one to move the bed right out center stage and enact upon it an act of simulated sexual violence. And after that, you don't get the bed off stage. I mean, it almost opens the door up for a deluge of stage sensationalism.
Now, why is it sexual violence? It's violence. Othello murders Desdemona. But are you saying sexual simply because he's a male and she's a female?
It would be different if it were not placed on the bed, uh-huh. on the wedding sheets, but with Othello strangling Desdemona, she dying in mm-hmm. sort of paroxysms in the murderous embrace of the husband.
Mm-hmm. Margherita?
In addition to the fact that the way the murder is staged on top of the bed, in addition to the fact that that suggests the sexual nature of the violence, the coupling of Othello and Desdemona has from the very start been given very definite, you know, sexual and bestial overtones through Iago's innuendos.
That's right.
That's how they're first introduced as a couple, mm-hmm. In their bestiality, in their sexuality. Also, what's involved in Othello's murdering of Desdemona is, of course, a sexual motive. She's betrayed me sexually, and on the bed, I am going to exact justice upon her by destroying her for that violation of my right.
Let's come back to Linda Booth's point about how the audience participates mm-hmm. in this act, the audience as voyeur. Is this what you mean when you say that Shakespeare was taking risks?
Yes. One of the questions that the students want to know when you're teaching this play, and they ask it with a certain nervousness, but it's, did Othello and Desdemona ever consummate this? Did they or didn't they? And if so, when? And that question is just built into the text of this play. For instance, in Romeo and Juliet, which is an earlier version in many ways of Othello, you don't ask the question. Our prurience is never invited into that drama. You know that they consummated the marriage, and so you don't have to go around wondering and peering inside. This play invites it. And Iago's very first question to Othello is, "Are you fast married?" Mm-hmm. And it's almost ours. it solicits our prurience in a way that makes puts us in a difficult relationship mm-hmm. to the play.
Margretta?
Would you say, Linda, too, that by doing this, that is by arousing in the audience this kind of interest in whether Desdemona and Othello have slept together, that what's happening is that Othello's concerns about Cassio and Desdemona are being replicated in the audience in terms of Othello and Desdemona, that is, his concern with Desdemona's making love with Cassio is repeated in the audience's concern with whether or not Othello and Desdemona have consummated their love. If that's the case, then we have another possible way of responding to your question, Wayne, about whether the audience is invited to identify with Othello from the start. If we're having thoughts of the same order as his about mm-hmm. what's going on stage, we're immediately cast into him.
Mm-hmm. Here, this play, it leads us, and it is always heading into that bedroom, and it leads us deeper and deeper into the play. Iago says to Othello at one point, Othello is demanding, I want satisfaction. He wants ocular proof. And Iago says, would you, the supervisor, grossly gape on, behold her topped? Yes, that's what Othello wants. And finally, it's what the audience wants too. Our aesthetic satisfaction is bound up in the same pornographic fantasy that Othello's need for ocular proof is bound up in, and it's a very damning kind mm-hmm. of identification.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the concluding segment in a two-part discussion about William Shakespeare, whose birth and death anniversaries in April 1985 date back to the years 1564 and 1616 in Elizabethan England. The Soundings panelists are Linda Boos of the University of California at Los Angeles and Margretta De Grazia of the University of Pennsylvania. Their conversation focuses on Shakespeare's tragedy about love, marriage, and human sexuality, Othello, The Moor of Venice. Linda Boos is the editor of a forthcoming anthology of feminist literary criticism entitled Fathers and Daughters. Margretta De Grazia completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where she worked on a project entitled Speaking on Shakespeare's Terms. Here is Margretta De Grazia.
I'm very convinced by the way you describe the movement of the play. What I find disturbing is the feeling the audience must be left with if a production does in fact arouse that kind of prurient, voyeuristic, sexual interest in the audience, then deliver to them what they have been wanting all along, the implication being, the purpose being presumably to chastise them for precisely the kind of impulse that the play has been arousing. I keep thinking of the traditional definition of the proper ultimate response of a tragedy being something like catharsis or purgation, the purgation perhaps of what one would want to dispel from one's character, from one's being. And here at the end of the play, by your reading of it, the audience is left feeling guilty, dirty, contaminated, slimy. What does an audience do leaving a play with that feeling? And what do you do? You see, if a play can induce that kind of feeling in an audience and leave them with it, close the curtain on it, send them home with it, what happens to it? That's what I find so frightening, and that's what also makes me want to think, I don't want to read the play that way. I don't want to see it doing what you're saying it's doing.
Well, Margretta, how do you read it?
Well, I don't know, and once you think of the play in the terms that Linda Boos has outlined, once you see that impetus towards the bed scene, once you see the way the audience is invited to respond, one of the things that occurs to me when I hear the play described as Linda Boos has is that perhaps more should be made between the distinction, more should be made with the distinction between eye and ear. Yes, there's a spectacle on stage. Yes, it poisons sight. Yes, it has to be hidden. And indeed, a lot of the language of the play has emphasized looking. But in fact, the play has worked not through the organ of the eye, but the organ of the ear. Othello seduces Desdemona in his terms, in her terms, through the ear. She devoured up his discourse, the story of his past. And Iago seduces Othello through the ear. Othello sees nothing. He wants ocular proof. He sees nothing that is not mediated by language. And I'm not quite sure if the play leaves us with simply a spectacle at the end. I'm not sure if we're not meant to ask something like, aren't we relying too much on sight when it's actually speech that is deceiving us?
Margareta de Grazia, Linda Buss, let me ask you this. Who's the victim in Othello? Is it Desdemona or is it Othello himself? Is Othello the victim of Iago? Is that the principal wrong that occurs in this play? And from that we have the sexual fallout that Linda Buss has described. Linda, who is it? Who's the victim here?
Notice that Othello's question to Iago is just that. He asks it. He tries to mediate the question. He says, ask of this demi-devil why he hath usurped me body and soul. And Iago's response to that is, demand me nothing. You know what you know. I nevermore will speak word. And he will not answer. He will not give us a rational reason why. He just says, you know what you know. That enigmatic, frighteningly puts it back to us, somewhere you know what you know, but he will not answer Othello's pained question. Othello doesn't seem to be able to answer the question himself. Iago won't answer it. The society says, close it down, shut it off, let's get out of here.
But then Shakespeare's taking the same position towards us that Iago is taking towards Othello. Demand me nothing. It's your problem.
I don't know if Shakespeare is. I think the text
play.
Is. The text.
That's what I question.
The play examines feminine behavior in the face of this polarized, gender-polarized world. It's a world that starts out heading towards ultimate union of all polarities, and something about the Iago wedge that drives into the middle of this. It ends up with the most grotesque of polarities. It's a sad and extremely tragic ending in terms of the idea of human sexuality, and maybe that's why it seems to be an important play to look at that content that I think is not just modern, that was there and it's been something that cultures have preferred not to really investigate. It's mm-hmm. a pretty disturbing subject.
Margareta de Grazia, Linda Buss, our topic is Othello, sexuality in this important Shakespearean drama. What do we learn about men and women in this play? You've both pointed out that there are large, serious questions raised, that there may or may not be answers. But for you personally, what's there in the play that's important for a modern reader about the relationship of men and women? Margareta?
I suppose what strikes me about the relation of Othello and Desdemona is, in a sense, their complicity. And to some degree, I think that Iago is indispensable. I think that Iago is dispensable, because whatever tragedy is affected by the end of the play, it's the result of a potential for tragedy within Desdemona and Othello. Iago is simply the embodiment, the outward instigator of a conflict between the two. But what I keep seeing in all of Shakespeare's tragedy is this incredible complicity between male and female, so that I can't at certain points tell them apart as agents. Linda made a very striking case, I think, for the way Desdemona falls into these submissive female patterns after Othello has been turned against her. But she's being submissive to Othello in the same way Othello has been submissive to Iago. He seems simply an echo, an important notion of Othello. She seems simply an echo of Othello's own behavior, just as when she's the warrior, she seems like an amplification or an echo of his very identity. So what I see in Othello at this point, what I see in so many of the Shakespearean tragedies, is the woman used as a complicitous extension of male behavior. In other words, the woman as woman, for me, never emerges in the Shakespeare plays, in the Shakespeare tragedies. She's always shrouded by what the male has projected onto her.
Linda Boos?
It's interesting when you compare Shakespeare's treatment of these subjects with the other contemporary dramatists, that this problem of virgin and whore seems to obsess the culture. The idea of males as cuckolds, and you notice we don't have an antonym there. There's no such term for a female cuckold. That's just wife, I guess. I mean, that was not a special category. We've come a long way in the sense that, notice that cuckold jokes in our society, they're not even present. They're not even particularly funny. Men don't seem to be so neurotically worried about being cuckolds. They're very prevalent still, say, in Latin America, in parts of Italy, where the way one man puts down another man is by alluding to the fact or the pretense that his wife may be sleeping with someone else. This Shakespeare's culture is obsessed with this. They're cuckold jokes in every single play in the Renaissance that I can think of. Yet when you get the treatment of this subject with most of the other dramatists, it seems almost inevitable that 'tis pity but she is a whore, that husbands will set up a best friend to go test their wives, and sure enough, beneath every one of those women, it turns out she really is a whore. The fantasy gets reified, not exposed, as a dangerous fantasy that exists in the male mind and drives on a terrible sort of behavior and division of the sexes. Shakespeare seems, and very much so in Othello, to go out of his way to expose it, not reify it, but show it as a terrible and destructive fantasy. It's not just in that play he does it. He does it in several plays, that same theme, that he goes out of his way to make sure that the woman is not at all what this male imagines her to be and creates her in that image. She denies his projection. Her reality is counter to his projection. But it, in terms of what Margareta was saying, it's often so subsumed beneath his projection that her reality never gets a chance. It's coerced by it. But I find a big difference, in any case, between Shakespeare and his contemporaries on this whole theme.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the second segment in a two-part conversation about William Shakespeare, the world's most popular poet and playwright. April 1985 marks the birth and death anniversaries of Shakespeare in the years 1564 and 1616 during the English Renaissance period. The panelists for Soundings were Linda Boos of the University of California at Los Angeles and Margareta De Grazia of the University of Pennsylvania. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Margareta De Grazia worked on a project entitled Speaking on Shakespeare's Terms. Next week on Soundings, a conversation with another scholar at the National Humanities Center. Professor Tom Reagan of North Carolina State University will discuss his book, The Case for Animal Rights, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in 1983. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.